You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. With all the stresses of life, it can be easy to lose perspective on what really matters. But Heineken believes that life is about being with friends and opening yourself to new experiences. Because when you live spontaneously and embrace the unexpected, it's a chance to create new stories and connections. You just have to open it. So enjoy a refreshingly cold, full-bodied Heineken Lager today. With its deep golden color, light fruity aroma, mild bitter taste, and a crisp, clean finish. Cheers. And now, enjoy the podcast.
I don't know if you guys have been paying attention to the entertainment business, but a bad time to be a predator. If you're doing that, cut it out. It sucks. We're losing like three actors a day. I feel like I'm going to see the new Avengers movie. Like, why is everyone being played by Paul Giamatti? They're like, he's the only one left. It's a weird time. There's a hockey team called the Predators. The Nashville Predators. Which in this climate, very ballsy. Because it's actors now, but it's going to be athletes next. And that's going to be a weird press release when they're like, we at the Predators are shocked. This is not what the Predators stand for. We'd like to be known as the alleged Predators, if possible.
Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. That was a clip from comedian Sam Morrell's recent appearance on Conan. He's a popular fixture of the New York comedy scene. He was named one of Comedy Central's comics to watch, and his debut comedy album, Class Act, went to number one on iTunes. Not only that, but he's received the closest thing there is to a comedy seal of approval from none other than Amy Schumer, who says he's one of her favorite comics, and she believed in him so much that she's even produced his new hour-long stand-up special, Sam Morrell, Positive Influence, which airs Friday, September 14th at 11 Eastern on Comedy Central. And today Sam joins me on the podcast to talk about getting his start as an intern on The Colbert Report, the sink or swim experience of breaking into the New York comedy scene, and some of his worst gigs ever. He shares the perils of dating and joking about your love life, and his unusual relationship with his therapist. He talks about some of the jokes that have gotten him in trouble with overzealous social justice warriors, how he handles the moral outrage police on social media, and how he sums up the whole internet experience as sad meets mean. Plus, we talk about how the Me Too movement is changing stand-up. Coming up with comedian Sam Morrell in just a moment. Sam Morrell is one of the fastest rising stand-up comics in New York City and one of the best joke writers on the scene today. He was named one of Comedy Central's comics to watch in 2011 and has performed on Comedy Central's Adam Devine's House Party, The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, and Conan. In 2015, his debut album Class Act went to number one on iTunes and made numerous top 10 lists. Morrell was the host of his very own show on MSG called People Talking Sports, which ran for two seasons and received an Emmy nomination. And now he has his first hour-long stand-up special airing on Comedy Central Friday, August 14th. It's called Sam Morrell, Positive Influence. Sam, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you've got this new special on Comedy Central, and you have some history with them, right? I read that you started out as an intern on the Colbert Report.
Yeah. Wow. The way you said that made it sound like we dated. We have some history. I interned there many years ago, and I don't think that had anything to do with my relationship with them, though.
Right.
Think, you know, they see you as an intern. They're not like, we got to develop this talent, you know? So.
Yeah. Yeah. You probably came in and they didn't remember that, I'm sure.
No. I think even actually how Colbert brings me out on his show is he said, this guy was apparently my intern, which I like that he didn't even like fake it at all. I'm like, yeah, you don't remember. They shuffle us in and out.
Was he a pretty good boss?
Yeah, he was awesome.
Yeah.
He's great. I mean, that was also, like, I realize now, I'm like, that was one of the best shows ever.
That was just genius, how committed he was to the character.
Oh, my God.
It was incredible.
It was a classic. Like, people try to redo that formula so much, and it's like Animal House. Good luck following that, you know?
Yeah, and I love him on CBS. He's so funny, you know, even when he's just being himself. But, again, I just loved his commitment to the character and how every joke derived from his perspective as, like, a conservative talk show host.
It was great,
every question he asked guests.
Well, you can go further with a character, you know? I mean, it's like when you watch South Park. You know, children and animation, it's like they can do anything.
Yeah.
So when you have that character, it was like, well, he can say anything to these prominent guests.
It was
amazing. The perfect setup for a comedy.
Now, I've heard stories from other guests about how intense it was working on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. And, of course, The Colbert Report spun off of The Daily Show. Was it equally hectic as an intern on that show?
I wouldn't say hectic. We'd be doing weird stuff. They'd be like, go to Harlem and get this anchor. And I'd be like, an anchor in Harlem? I'd be like, yeah, go. I'd be like, all right. You just kind of
like a news anchor or like a literal anchor?
A literal anchor that they wanted for a sketch. So stuff like that where I wouldn't say intense, but I'd say, you know, you want to do your part. I mean, you're the lowest end of the totem pole. So let's not mess this up.
And I'm sure people can tell from your accent, you are a native New Yorker,
right?
I am,
yeah.
What part of New York did you grow up in?
Originally Flatiron, then the Upper East Side, and I'm currently an Upper West Sider.
Okay.
New York's, it's home. I love it. It's the best. It's funny. I don't get told that I have an accent unless leave. That's the only time people are like, you have an accent.
Yeah. Do you leave a lot? I wonder, as a New York comic, I mean, it's very easy to get labeled as, well, a New York comic. So do you fight against that? Do you try to tour a lot?
Yeah, you got to tour. I mean, that's, for me, the only way I can write new material is by, like, if you're in New York, you're doing 15-minute sets every night.
Yeah.
So I can't, if I do, like, five new minutes or newish minutes, it could derail the whole set. Whereas if I do that in an hour, it's not as noticeable. It's just like, he tried a couple things.
When you came up as a comic, you were already in the ultimate comedy mecca. I imagine, you know, that kind of thing can be sort of a mixed blessing because most comics, you know, they have the luxury of starting out in a smaller comedy town like, I don't know, Houston, Phoenix, wherever, so they can kind of develop their act and find their own voice, make their mistakes where the stakes aren't quite so high. What was it like starting out in the New York comedy scene? It must have been a baptism of fire.
Well, yeah, it's a mixed bag because, you know, if you come from Minnesota, as you said, you're a big fish in a small pond. But then it's kind of a rude awakening when you come to New York because a lot of people come and they're just like, why aren't I getting, I was so respected in Minnesota. Well, it's New York. No one cares, you know? So, I think some people probably saw me when I wasn't good. And there's going to be the people that are like, well, I saw him 5 years ago and he's not good. And it's like, well, you can get good. But there's those people that look at you like, well, you're just not good, I've decided.
Yeah.
And then there's the other people that see you and they're just like, well, this guy's been around a long time and he's kind of paid his dues. And I've seen him when he was young. So I kind of like that he's doing all right now.
Okay.
So I think it's
mixed. Don't feel that it hurts you that badly if, you know, kind of there are people who remember you from a year or two back when you were just finding your legs as a comic.
It's nice to have a little more
mystique.
I wish I had a little more mystique. I mean, I think having come in comics when you know less, it's kind of interesting because you know, you go to that fantasy and you're like, well, I bet this person's like this.
Yeah.
You know, it's like early on in a relationship and then you know more and you're like, well, I like them less now. So there's part of me that wishes that less was known, but I also, you know, at each level I'd be starting to play better clubs and better clubs and I'd be around better and better comics and it really does push you to get better. But if you start, as you said, Minnesota, you know, something like that, they have a great club called Acme. So maybe you're the local guy who's working at Acme. You open for the headliner that comes to town. You get to develop relationships that way. So you meet and you learn in different ways. But for me, I kind of like the way it happened in New York.
Yeah, but I mean, if you're in Boise or D.C., you don't have to worry about there being a talent scout
like
from the Late
Boise
Show or something.
Boise or D.C., like those are similar cities.
I know. But,
D.C.,
you know,
there
but
might be some talent.
Oh, D.C. apparently has a really good comedy scene, it turns out. You'd be surprised. Boise, I have no idea. I don't know.
I
don't know how that came to mind. I think some comic I know must be going to Boise soon, and that's how it stuck in my mind, I think. But now, you know, I always hate asking this question because I almost feel bad whenever I ask a comic who their inspirations were, who they looked up to, but it is sincerely out of interest.
Sure.
I'm always really interested in who someone either modeled themselves after or, you know, who as a kid you thought was funny and that sort of thing.
Sure. Well,
and I know you're sick of that, and every comic is sick of that question.
I
can't help myself.
I'm fascinated by it too. I mean, you know, you go through different stages of who inspires you and what inspires you. And that's the cool thing about, you know, just growing up is you, like, I went through like an angry Bill Hicks phase where I was like, this guy's like, but then I started to like less when he was self-righteous and more when he was just being funny. Yeah. I loved Rodney Dangerfield so much growing up. Like, to me, he was just the funniest person.
Yeah.
Like, if you're in a room with that guy, how are you not just drawn, you know, to how funny he was nonstop? I mean, Back to School, it's just one great joke after another. I think of that scene when his wife's leaving him and Back to School as like a perfect comedy scene where, like, you know, you should be devastated. Your wife's cheating on you. She's leaving. And he just keeps rattling off one-liners on her.
Yeah.
It's kind of incredible.
Yeah. And I kind of miss that. I miss the jokey comics. And there's a little bit of that to you, I think, because you're jokey without being hacky. You know, you're definitely wry and subversive. But at the same time, there's a little bit of kind of that classic old school joke form of like a Henny Youngman, George Burns, Rodney Dangerfield type. As a Jewish comic growing up in New York, did you ever have much of a connection to that Borscht Belt comic heritage?
That's an interesting question. I don't think consciously I did, but I definitely love jokes, and there is almost like a Jewishness to that type of humor. Like, my grandfather would almost speak in that way, where he'd be like,
the rhythm of it.
Yeah, that rhythm where he'd be like joking about my grandma, where he'd be like, oh, my grandma, your grandma, you know, she kicked me the other day. And I'd be like, what? He's like, we got into a fight and she kicked me. I'm like, I'm lucky she's old and can't kick any higher. Like, stuff like, he would speak in that rhythm where I'd be like, oh, that's like Dangerfield. That's how he talks.
Yeah, exactly.
So I guess that definitely rubbed off on me. I'm like, well, that's almost like the rhythm of a joke. And, you know, you say I have a little of that in me. I think you try to modernize it so it sounds conversational and doesn't sound like a joke. But, I think that style is in me for sure.
Right. But you definitely have the setup and the punch and the form is there. But is young and modern and, you know, it's not Take My Wife, Please or something.
But it's a great joke. I mean, that joke is timeless, right? I mean, so you try. I think what I want is to get a rhythm going where I can pause and they know that a joke is coming, like you said. Mm-hmm. So like that way is a way for me to get them in my rhythm for the whole show.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, I think that rhythm becomes predictable after a while. And you see, if you listen to a Dangerfield album, he starts doing crowd work to mix it up and throw him off a little. So with me, I'll do stories. I'll do some other stuff just to, because I think an hour of that style is too much.
Has your comedy changed much since you first started out?
Yeah, definitely. Because I think when you start out, you'll say anything that's funny.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You're like, well, this is funny. I don't know if I like it or agree with it, but this is funny. And then after a while, you're like, I want to write a joke about this. Like, I just had this happen to me. This kind of hurt me. And it'll help me therapeutically if I can execute something really good about it. Like, if there's a lot of breakup jokes in this special, and it caused me a lot of pain. I love the person a lot. So I was like, it'll be my mission to make that really funny. And, you know, relationship and breakup jokes play well because it's something that we all feel.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a go-to on the road.
You do talk a lot about dating and failed relationships quite a bit. I wonder, has processing those breakups in your comedy or through your comedy made you any better at relationships?
I don't think so.
No, you haven't learned a damn thing.
My friend Nick Griffin's such a great comic, and he has a joke I love where he said, I learned nothing from relationship to relationship. None of my credits transfer. But that's how I feel, I think. I learn, therapy has helped me more than comedy, but it also is like I'm aware. I feel like therapy's made me aware of where I go wrong, but now I'm aware and I'm going to keep doing it. It doesn't change the patterns. It's made me conscious of the patterns.
Yeah.
But the jokes help in that I guess I don't want to keep going down the same road because I want to grow not as a not only as a person but comedically as well. I don't want to keep retreading the same ground of dating unavailable or emotionally unavailable women. So, yeah, I think it's something that I don't know has made me better, but it's definitely made me aware. I don't know. I don't think the jokes have helped me.
Yeah, no. Have they hurt you?
Yeah, they've. I mean, I've gotten into fights over them. Oh, I remember I did a Conan set about a breakup. I was on and off with a girl, and I loved her very much. And
yeah, don't do breakup humor when you're on and off.
Well, I thought it was
wait
over.
Till it's really a breakup.
I take their word for it when they say I'm never getting back with you, and she's like, "Well, I didn't mean that," and I'm like, "Well, I don't fucking know," you know. So I remember we were like out that night together after I did it. She wouldn't come with me to do the set because she's like, I don't want your agents staring at me when you're doing jokes about me. And I was like, that's fair. And I remember we were out at like a comedy show and I tried to like hold her hand and she hit it away. And she's like, you just made fun of me on TV. And I was like, yeah, that's fair. That's a fair point.
Yeah, before we went on mic, you were talking about, I think you just gotten a text from your therapist and he misses you. You two seem to have a very special relationship.
Well, I think you always want to think that your therapist likes you, like that he looks forward to your stories.
Yeah.
I think, you know, because you're like, oh, like, you know, I'm an entertainer. I feel like I'm a little more of a flowery storyteller than, say, this woman that works in marketing before or whoever he has. But, you know, actually a lot of my comic friends see the same therapist. He used to see Richard Lewis, which to me is like,
oh, wow.
Is there a better credit as a therapist?
Yeah.
You know, like that's how they should bring you out. Your next therapist, so Richard Lewis,
yeah,
the most anxious comedian ever.
Yeah, do you ever feel pressure following other comics when you go into
it? I have a joke about that in the special. I say, you know, I heard a comic before and I heard through the door my therapist laughed and I go, oh my God, I got to bring it again this week. So yeah, you do feel a little pressure. And also it's like, it's not a great feeling when you just poured your heart out and you go out and you see like, I know that guy.
Yeah.
I don't want him to see me slumped over.
Do you usually try to make your therapist laugh?
Do you feel that pressure
as a comic?
No, I used to. There's definitely like, he has a dark sense of humor and I guess I do too. So that to me is very Jewish too, is like that.
Yeah.
My uncle is like that. My grandma was like that. I mean, I remember when they buried my grandpa, they were together since they were like teenagers, my grandparents, and as they buried my grandfather, my grandmother, who's, you know, late 80s at the time, just goes, well, that's that. And I was like, and my uncle is hilarious. He just got t-shirts made that said that's that on them. And I was like, that's like, to me, such Jewish humor, or at least like New York Jewish humor to me, where it's like, it doesn't mean we're not affected, but we do find it kind of funny. Something morbid about Jewish humor.
Yeah, the Jews, I guess, has to do with their history. They know shit happens, and you take it in stride, and if you can, you joke about it.
That's a good point. I guess my therapist, you know, he texts me, I miss your frown, which I think is a funny thing to say. So as I said, you know, I think I said this to you off air, but Jews, a lot of Jews I know, we speak in complaints.
Uh-huh.
Like, that's how we speak. It's not like, we'll just catch up and like, can you believe this? And some people find that to be complaining. I'm like, no, that's how we communicate.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not really mad. It's just, that's how we talk. Yeah. Did you hear about this?
Yeah. What was it? Someone did a joke. I'm trying to remember who it was, but they said two Gentiles meet on the street and the other says, how's business? The other one says, great.
That's
and
perfect.
It's like a joke. You only get the joke if you're not a Gentile.
Right. Totally. That's perfect.
You talk a lot in the special about Charlottesville and kind of the ego of the KKK and their distorted self-image.
Right.
Growing up as a Jew in New York, were you largely sheltered from that kind
of
anti-Semitism?
Of course. I mean, there's a joke in there where I go on the road and I talk about my worst anti-Semitic moment. And the joke is that it wasn't bad at all. Of course, I was sheltered from it. Being a Jew in New York, it's not. I used to have a joke where I said, where I would just say, I heard the. I said I used to walk around and say, I used to say, fuck the police a lot.
Yeah.
You know, I say it was hard growing up white in Manhattan, you know? So, I mean, you know, of course I was sheltered from it all. But then, you know, I start reading about it and I start seeing it. And, you know, of course I hear a lot of those people speaking about Charlottesville that they were like, we were joking. I'm like, well, you're holding torches.
We were joking?
That's what they said. They said the whole Jews will not replace us was like a troll. It was like a joke. But I'm like, yeah, well, context is everything, and you were holding torches. And Yeah. In a large group.
That pisses me off when people go and say generally hateful, horrific things and then say, oh, I was just trolling, or Trump's just trolling the media, you know, when he says, don't take it seriously.
Words
How do you
have
know
impact.
What to take seriously
Words have
not?
Impact, so I choose mean. Carefully. That's why I, you know, with those dark subjects, I don't like to riff. I like to think them out and then perform them because people talk about free speech and how it's being taken away, and it's like, well, it's not being taken away, but words have impact, and you should be conscious of that when you say things.
Yeah.
And if you're going to show up with torches and say anti-Semitic shit,
you should expect to be taken seriously.
Your salary might take a hit. Don't be surprised that people don't want to employ you and that goes viral. Some people I say, you know, think free speech is saying whatever you want with no consequence. Mm-hmm. And those are, I don't get those rights at home.
Yeah. You've learned that the hard way, haven't you?
People can react to what you're saying. There's always, I mean, look, I definitely have mixed feelings about people costing people work. Mm-hmm. When people start protesting and say, you should not hire this guy, and pressure people to fire them. Mm-hmm. I mean, but at the same time, there's people that are generally, I think intent goes a long way. And there's people that want to have a discourse who have opposing views. And there's people who are, as you said, just trolling.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Sam Morrell when we come back in just a moment. Are you smarter or more devoted than the average NFL fan? Then be sure to catch the Move the Sticks podcast, hosted by former NFL scouts Daniel Jeremiah and Bucky Brooks. Jeremiah and Brooks break down the most impressive performances of the week, explaining how individual players and teams are able to be successful based on their skill sets, technique, and coaching decisions. The Move the Sticks podcast provides detailed analysis of the college and pro game from seasoned experts. From the NFL combined straight through the Super Bowl, there's no off-season on the Move the Sticks podcast. With guests like NFL GMs, head coaches, and top draft prospects, no one brings you the inner workings of football better than the Move the Sticks podcast. Having followed the league's top talent from high school to the NFL draft, DJ and Bucky will tell you exactly who will emerge as the next big stars. Subscribe now to the Move the Sticks podcast with new episodes dropping 3 times a week, available on your favorite podcast app or NFL.com. Folks, I'm so happy to have Bombas as a new sponsor of the podcast because I'm a huge sock guy. I know that sounds weird, but it's true. Everyone who's been on the show knows I always have some funky socks on my feet. Not funky as in smelly, but funky as in fun colors, whimsical, fashion-forward, but also functional and comfortable. And as a sock connoisseur, let me say that nobody makes a better sock than Bombas. Thanks to 2 years of research and development and multiple improvements in design, performance, and comfort, Bombas are the most comfortable socks in the history of feet. With an arch support system that provides extra support where you need it most and a cushioned footbed that's reinforced for comfort without added bulkiness, Bombas feel like a hug around your foot. Not to mention, Bombas Stay Up technology ensures that your socks stay in place without leaving a mark. And the super soft cotton material makes you never want to take them off. So whether you're a runner, power walker, or power lounger, that's me, there's a pair of Bombas that'll add comfort to your life. As a matter of fact, I'm wearing a pair of purple Bombas Marl's calf-length socks even as we speak. They come in every color of the rainbow, and I ordered them all because they look great and they're easily the most comfortable socks I've ever owned. There's a good reason. These socks are scientifically engineered for comfort. Think about that. How much time do you spend trying to find a comfortable pair of shoes? Now ask yourself how much thought you've ever given to your socks. Socks go on your feet too, folks, and if you're suffering from tired feet, consider this. Maybe you've got the right shoes, but the wrong socks. You owe it to your feet to find out what a perfectly engineered sock feels like. Take it from me, they're a game changer. Go to bombas.com/kick and use the code KICK for 20% off your first order. That's Bombas, bombas.com/kick, code KICK, and you'll get 20% off your first order. And now, back to the podcast. Some of your best material gets to something that you've battled with, I think, probably for a big chunk of your career, which is internet trolls and social justice warriors. You say something that I thought was a little bit brilliant. You define the internet as sad meets mean.
That's what it feels like.
What do you mean by that?
Well, there's only, I feel like people just air grievances in a way that's so self-indulgent. Like they, as we say, like words mean something, but on the internet, you're anonymous and people just throw stuff out there without any second thought. It just goes up. I see some stuff on Facebook sometimes where people are just like, had a rough day. I'm sad. I'm like, you're just putting that into the abyss? You're just throwing that out there? So there's that. And then there's the people that will just comment underneath that. Well, it's like, well, get a life. And you're like, well, both of you are scaring me. What the hell is going on? What's happening?
Yeah.
There used to be like the strong silent type. I feel like, you know, I remember Tony Soprano always talks about that on Sopranos. What happened to the strong silent type?
Yeah, what happened to the men of the 50s?
Right.
They all had heart attacks at 50.
They died young and weren't very good to women. Yeah. Let's face it. But they look good on film.
Yeah.
But there was, you know, in moderation, there's something nice about that, about being able to kind of, you know, like John McCain just passed away. And I think there's a lot of interesting conversation about him where he wasn't a perfect guy. And I really disliked a lot of things he stood for. I'd say most of the things he stood for. But he was like a real man's man in so many ways.
Yeah.
And I think he was, we talk about disagreeing. I think he was a decent guy.
Even if I disagreed with him on things, I kind of believe that whatever he was doing, he did it because in his heart, he really believed that it was the right thing to do, which is crazy nostalgic now to even contemplate something like that.
But isn't that weird? Yeah, it's like, it's funny how I remember George Bush kept saying, well, history will judge my presidency. And God damn it, he was right. who saw that coming?
Yeah.
But, sure. You know, yeah, I think the internet really does depress me. And I think it's important to remember to disengage and to unplug because you I think start to internalize that stuff, that sadness or that cruelty. And it's not who we are. But when you're on the internet, there's something about it where you're like, well, I guess this is a part. Like you just see it's you would never speak to a person this way.
No.
But for some reason, people just write shit to me that I'm like, oh, I can't believe a person just, I mean, that's so strange.
Yeah. Yeah, I had someone on who talked about the science of it and how it's way better if you're going to have a political conversation, just have it face-to-face or over the phone, just verbally. It completely changes the DNA of that conversation and how you treat the other person as opposed to, like, writing an email or, God forbid, going on Facebook or Twitter. And,
I mean, think about 3D guns now. Even interaction at the gun store was with a human.
Yeah.
Now you're just like, I read a comment, I'm going to print
a
gun.
That's interesting.
You know what I mean?
I never thought about that.
Human interactions, it's good to be around people to see that there is good in people. I mean, tone is so often interpreted negatively. Like if you get an email, you're like, what did this mean? It probably meant nothing.
Text.
But how often do we interpret the worst from any writing?
Mm-hmm. Now, do you ever engage with your Twitter trolls?
I have.
Try to mix it up.
I don't really anymore. I remember I had a talk at that sports show, and they please stop engaging with trolls because I would jokingly just. I remember on one of them, I think I say it in the special, but they say someone tweeted me, "Your comedy's a waste," and I retweeted it and wrote, "Your father's jizz was a waste." So, but then after that, they were like, "You should stop doing stuff like that." I was like, "That's fair." So I don't really anymore, but it's pointless. They want they're doing it to get a rise. So I think if you just don't give them anything,
I think you said that when you had your show on MSG, they made you go through like some kind of media training or whatever.
Well, they were like,
what kind of things do they tell you?
Certain things you can say and can't say. It was pretty basic.
Oh, okay.
It was, and they were actually, I think, pretty fair about it.
It wasn't specific to you.
No. I mean, I think
more standards and practices.
I think it was probably somewhat specific because they're not used to having comedians on their network. And I think they were like, let's just make sure this guy is, they had like a billboard of me on Penn Station on MSG and stuff. So they're like, you're the face of our network right now. So could you not, be reckless? And I was like, that's fair.
You know? Now, apparently even your mom trolls you on Facebook, right?
Yeah. My mom is hilarious because she'll do like, I'll talk to her on the phone. I'll just like, sometimes I'll run jokes by her because I want it to be funny to everybody, you know? So I'll run a joke by her and she'll laugh and go, that's not funny. I'm like, we just laughed. You know, I feel like that's like trolling me.
Yeah.
Or she'll like, she is furious whenever I use the wrong grammar.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if I say less instead of fewer, I mean, oh my God. I she's like, God. And I'm just like, Mom, she's right. She's, she's very smart.
She's right.
So words matter to her. And we're talking about how words matter. And the language is being butchered worse and worse every day. So
good
like I
her.
Talk about this a lot is that your humor as a comic, like what type of jokes you tell come mm-hmm. from your relationship with your parents, I think. Mm-hmm. And my mom was always, growing up, I'd always, you know, I was in a blended family. So my brother and sister who, you know, stepbrother and stepsister were, you know, were very quiet. And I was like a loud, gabby Jew. I was just talking all the time. And I would try to get a rise out of people because everyone was so quiet. So I would just say something inappropriate. And my mom would always be like, Sam. And I feel like that's my sense of humor defined. It's just my mom saying, Sam.
Yeah.
It's just me poking her a little bit.
Yeah. Every family has one of those, though.
It's usually the
one
youngest.
Who kind of says what everyone's thinking or says, you know, whenever it's awkward, just breaks the ice and makes it a little bit better.
I think so.
Now, you've run afoul of the moral outrage police once or twice in your career. You got a lot of crap for a joke that you made about Kendall Jenner on Colbert. And then your act, you actually talk about
Caitlin, not Kendall.
Oh, Caitlin. Oh, Caitlin. Yeah. I get them mixed up. Which one? I don't even know.
Caitlin's the Olympic hero.
That's Bruce Jenner.
Yeah. Wait,
okay, Bruce Jenner. Okay, Bruce Jenner, who is now Caitlin Jenner.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. In your act, you also talk about some woman who apparently she was so upset by some joke that you made that she actually took the time to write the club afterwards.
Yeah, people do that sometimes, and the seller's always pretty supportive. They wrote the Comedy Cellar. The Comedy Cellar forwarded me the email, ha ha ha, with an exclamation point. I mean, they find it funny because I think they see me as a bit of a nuisance, but you know, they know that the intent is usually good. I remember Esty, who books the club, who's, you know, obviously been very good to me over the years. She's really been supportive always, and you never know how people feel about you. I know she booked me, but you never know until they, and she did an interview, I remember, when I did Colbert and for some local thing on CBS, and she said, I really like the way he walks the line carefully.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's times she's happier and not as happy with me. And I think the whole Gator thing, she's like, what did he do now? So we were on the Comedy Cellar podcast talking about the whole Gator thing. And
remind us, because you were making fun of something that had just happened.
A baby, he went down easy. It was a baby that got eaten by a gator at Disney.
Yeah. And not on the Jungle Ride, a real gator, right?
A real gator. And Comedy Central, I think, did not want this in the special. So we had to fight them, apparently. I didn't know how close it got to being cut, but it went from not being in the special to apparently the whole thing's going to be on YouTube, that whole bit. So we changed our mind, but it was, you know, I had to go out there and be like, Comedy Central does not endorse this bit. And I'm like, you know, they don't think there's anything funny. And I'm like, me personally, I think it's kind of funny, you know, but obviously it's not. It was being sarcastic. I mean, a baby got eaten. It's terrible. But my whole point was like, it's not about, I just use that to get into it. It's about the email. It's about the outrage.
Yeah.
But, you know, I remember I was on the Comedy Cellar podcast just talking about the baby that got eaten. And as we're talking about it, in the restaurant, a baby starts crying, and I'm like, it's like he knows, you know. I kind of disarmed her with that type of stuff, and it got a little, I think she got it. She heard the bit eventually and got it, I think.
Yeah.
It was, I don't think it's a malicious bit. I think it's just me understanding her. And as I said, intent is really everything with that to me, and if it's funny or not. And I think it hits. It would hit consistently, so.
Yeah, well, the question is, when is it too soon? And I've had this chat with Gilbert Gottfried, who's been in your shoes a couple of times.
Well, the Aristocrats, right? His whole thing was, he went hard.
With that and with the tsunami jokes.
Yeah, he lost out a lot of money.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean,
with corporate sponsors, it's like, always too soon.
Yeah, yeah. But it's, I mean, it's crazy how like a few tweets get people pissed off and then suddenly, like, that was his livelihood.
Think about how dangerous Twitter is for comedy. Think about how dangerous Twitter is, because jokes are about the moment, right? So context is everything, and it's not going to, as we said, how people assume the worst, they're going to look back and go, this was terrible. It's like, well, maybe it was in reference to that exact feeling in that moment, and you never get that moment or feeling back.
Yeah.
So it's only going to age horribly. Twitter's only going to hurt your career.
I mean, why is it that, you know, a year later it's okay to make that joke, but in the moment it's not? It's not like a year later after that happened that suddenly it's okay, like it's funny.
I think if the joke's funny, it'll...
Yeah, it's funny whenever it happens.
I did a Boston bombing joke
9/11 joke was kind of funny.
It was funny.
Which is horrible to say to a New Yorker, but...
No,
it's
not.
As a joke,
that's the whole thing
good.
Is like, so for some people... People are different. For some people, a dark joke about something that they were there for is upsetting and brings up, you know, pain. And other people, it provides relief and it feels good to laugh at something dark. So, you know, I remember I did a Boston bomber joke like right after it happened, because I thought of something and I made it about me. I said, you know, when I first heard, you know, I had family in Boston, I was devastated. My first thought was, me and my brother, we don't do anything together anymore. So I did that. I made it about me, and some people hated it, and other people were like, that made me laugh. And I was like, well, it doesn't feel good to laugh at something that's that awful. I mean, that's why I'm drawn to dark subjects. It feels good to find something. You know, it's like a challenge.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the first jokes that you make in this special, in fact, is about the whole Me Too phenomenon. And you say pretty much every movie is going to end up starring Paul Giamatti from now on, because it's like all the good talent is gone.
Right.
I hate to say it, but it's kind of true. I mean, just the other day I was watching L.A. Confidential again
over the
weekend.
One of the great movies of all time.
And I found myself just trying to, you know, somehow see if I could rationalize a Kevin Spacey comeback.
I mean, L.A. Confidential is one of the great movies of all time, I think. So, yeah, I mean, maybe they can keep playing that because you can justify, you know, because Kevin Spacey's in a supporting role.
You can justify watching.
Well, it's in a supporting role. I think if it's like House of Cards and he's the show, it's different. But I saw Horrible Bosses on TV, and he's got a small role in that, and they played that. And it's funny because he has a whole monologue in that. He's like, yeah, I did some bad things. And you're like, wow, it's like it's like he knew.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, I have a whole big – it's funny that Me Too chunk started a whole – like, I taped it. I just thought of that, like, the week of and threw it
in
there.
Oh, really? No kidding.
And because we shot in December, and then it turned into a whole big chunk. So my next special is going to have a big Me Too chunk, and I really like where it's at right now. I think I have some really fun takes. It's like – it's. I think it's inoffensive. I think it's just –
yeah.
It's a subject that I've had to kind of walk the line a little bit.
Oh, I'm sure.
Because I want to understand, you know, women's feelings about it, and I don't want to be – I don't want to jump in too quickly and think like, oh, great, a straight white guy's take on Me Too. And it's like, no, I want to listen to it. I think it'll make you laugh.
It's almost sacrilege to say this, but I mean, there is a line between a rapist like Harvey Weinstein and like the Kumail Nanjiani thing or Aziz Ansari.
Be careful.
Sorry, Kumail.
Holy shit.
I don't want to tarnish him. But I mean, you know,
I think people
are forgiven raping someone and a guy making a move.
Right. Well, there's like the people that even say that and they're like, oh, so what he did, and you're like, just if you can't even have a conversation, I think that's your whole point. It's like, well, I think, and also, as you say, Aziz has been forgiven and someone like Harvey is never going to be.
Yeah.
So,
no, he's
and not. Of course there's a difference. I mean, the people that get mad for pointing out a difference, we're not saying that any of this behavior is okay, but for a movement to take its course, you need to, A, as we've talked to, for certain people have a path to redemption, and B, understand what happened and you know, so on. Just maybe we need to learn as guys. We need to, because I've learned already. There's stuff I didn't know was, you know, I've heard and I was like, oh, I didn't realize this was such a bad environment for you. And I know that for women, comedy clubs are
bad.
That's true. I've had talks with waitresses where I've seen stuff and I've said, is that okay with you? And I've had to do that. And some are like old school where they're like, yeah, that's the business. And other people are like, you know, I don't think I've ever had it where they say, no, that's not, I'm not comfortable. But if it is, I think it's like, you got to make these environments safe for women. You got to make them feel good. And
And it's probably hard for a lot of guys to understand too, because like for a lot of women, it's something so subtle that no guy would actually pick up on it. But women being intuitive, they can tell when a vibe is off. They can tell when there's creepy
intent.
It would just completely go over our heads.
Drunk guys or like, no, the fact that they have to walk to their car late at night. Like, I hate thinking about that. Some of my best friends have to do that. And it makes me angry when I think about it.
One of your best female friends is Amy Schumer, I guess, who produced
this special.
Well, I
wouldn't say that, but I mean, we're friends. Okay. I mean, we're not like best friends. But
okay, that was a pretty bad segue then. She did produce the special, though, and she introduces you on stage as one of her favorite comics.
That was really
nice.
What
a huge compliment
cool.
That she's a fan of yours. How did all that happen?
Well, you know, her opener is this comic, Mark Normand, who is a good friend of mine, and Mark's a great comic, and you know, occasionally Mark wouldn't be able to do it. And I think she just, I guess, knew me through Mark. And Mark, I guess, spoke highly of me. And she saw me a couple of times and was like, all right, I'll use him.
Okay.
And then it went well. And she's a good hang on the road. She makes it very easy. And, one day we were just talking. I guess her mom quoted one of my bits.
Oh, yeah.
We were on her helicopter coming back from Philly, and her mom was quoting one of my bits, and Amy kept laughing. She was like, I really like that bit a lot. And she's like, I really like all your jokes. So Wow. if you think about doing a special, I'd love to be a part of it. And I was like, oh,
that's
wow.
That's a huge deal for her to stick her neck out for any comic like that.
It was
that.
Pretty cool. Well, she does that. She's super,
yeah,
I mean,
I guess she does.
You're aware
right.
of comics who do stuff like that.
She has done that.
There are a lot of big comics who don't do that. Mm-hmm. And Amy's one
yeah,
of the ones.
For sure.
It goes a long way when someone yeah. uses their clout to help others. And I think she's like that, not just in entertainment, but I think she's mm-hmm. very charitable. And, you know, she's conscious of giving back in more ways than one.
Now, how long did you have to work on this set before you were ready to do a special?
I think it was like 2 years or so.
2 years?
Ish. Around
yeah.
2 years.
Because this is your first hour long, right?
Yeah. The other one yeah. was an album and a so it was like a half hour special and then a album that was probably like 50 mm-hmm. minutes. And then this is an hour.
Before I forget, I want to compliment you on your opening scene for the special because I usually hate those.
Me too.
They really annoy me. And I don't know where in the whole comedy special chemistry someone decided that you have to make a student film before you go on stage.
Isn't
now.
It weird?
But I actually enjoyed yours because it's so offbeat and it's so New York that it really sets the tone for the whole show.
I felt that was all Amy, man. I mean,
oh, you really?
Know, well, I chose, I was like, I don't know what I want to do yet, but I want to shoot it at Barney Greengrass. I remember pitching her an idea and she kind of paused. She goes, or we could do something funny. And I was like, that's a good idea. And we're at Barney Greengrass and Steve Ast, who's one of the producers on it, brought in that older woman who you saw yeah. in the opening, and it just kind of, Amy was like, what if you tried to pick her up? I mean, you're just writing in your, because I wanted to capture that New York feeling yeah. of like, we're just in a coffee shop, we're isolated. I feel like we're almost like private eyes in a way. We're just trying to put things together alone. It's lonely existence. And then, if I just, you know, meet in a bagel, and if I just catch eyes with a much older woman, and she was so funny. All her facial expressions
yeah, yeah.
were so naturally funny. And
yeah.
She actually, she messaged me the other day. She's,
oh, no kidding.
She's going to come. I'm going to do a little premiere party, and she's going to come.
That's awesome. So, yeah, it was so strange, and it's so simple, really, like the whole setup.
But people overthink
things.
But
it was perfect for this. You know, it
wasn't it was simple and
some
weirdly
overblown,
sweet.
Ridiculous thing.
Yeah.
Are you doing a lot of touring after this?
I'm on the road a lot. I'm yeah. going, yeah, I'm hitting next month. This thing I start in, like, Fairfield, Connecticut, but then I'm off to, like, Atlanta, Cleveland, Dayton, Ohio, Tampa, Rhode Island. Like, I'm hitting a lot of different okay. markets, and I'm pumped, man. A lot of good clubs,
yeah.
so.
Yeah, and I always love to ask comics what their worst gig was, because
sure.
inevitably everyone has one.
There's
and
so many.
You sort of talk about one in the show, a casino in Reno that wasn't great, but
I did
what is the worst gig you've
I was
ever
like,
had?
This is the worst gig I've ever done. Really? I'll never come back. Then a year later, I'm like, yeah, I'll do it. There's a lot. One that always sticks out to me is I was working the door at this club called Broadway Comedy Club, and they would let me go on stage sometimes, and I went on stage, and it's not going well. A guy just keeps heckling me. And I was like, shut up. I tried to handle it in a witty way at first, and he just wouldn't go away. So, and the wait staff liked me because I worked the door. So we were kind of like, they felt like they were on my side. You know, they knew me from, like, I'm a comic, but I also am kind of one of them.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember this guy just standing up, and I'm like, what's he going to do? Is he going to? I'm like, you have that thing where you're like, am I going to have to fucking fight a guy? and this stuff like this has happened before where they rush the stage. But this one, for whatever reason, sticks out to me because it was so degrading. I remember I just hear, and I'm like, oh, no.
Oh, God.
And he just nails me right on the chest with spit. And he would have gotten closer, but all these tough Latina waitresses are barricading the stage, not letting him get to me. And then as he spits on me, the whole crowd just like, what do I do? He leaves, and I just decide to go into jokes. I'm like, I don't know what else to do, but it didn't play. They were like, they all looked at me like they pitied me. And I was like, yeah, as they should.
That's what every comic's going for. Well, Sam, you're a very funny man. Sam Morril, Positive Influence, airs Friday, August 14th on Comedy Central. And where can people get your tour dates?
SamMorril.com. They could go Twitter, Instagram. It's just my name, SamMorril.
Well, like I said, you're a very funny man. Folks, go check him out. And thanks for talking with me, Sam.
Thanks for having me, dude.
Thanks again to Sam Morril for coming on the podcast. His new hour-long comedy special, Sam Morril, Positive Influence, airs September 14th at 11 Eastern and Pacific on Comedy Central. Again, check his upcoming live shows at sammorril.com and follow him on Twitter at @SamMorril. You deserve a better email marketing platform. And unlike other email providers, Emma puts its customers first. It's powerful email marketing with a personal touch.
Their award-winning team is always ready to support you on your email marketing strategy, design, list migration, and more, so you'll have everything you need to do your best email marketing yet. Request a customized demo of Emma's email marketing platform today at myemma.com. Again, that's myemma.com. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.